Hello and welcome to Ed Talks, the podcast from King Edward School Birmingham and King Edward High School for Girls, where I speak to old Edwardians about their life since they crossed Edgbaston Park Road for the very last time and took off that blue blazer or that bright green jumper. Today I'm joined by two old Eds who are working together, which is incredibly exciting. I'm joined by Professor Oliver Johnson, who left school in 1992, and Rick Ubi, who left school in 2004. Oliver, you've got a book coming out this week, isn't it, as we record?
Tomorrow, in fact.
This book is called Number Crunch, A Mathematician's Toolkit for Making Sense of Your World. We'll come back to that in a second, Oliver, because I need to introduce why Rick is here too. Rick, would you mind telling me, so we've got the author of the book here, but what is your link with Oliver? How do you guys know each other?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm the editorial director of a publisher called Bonnier Books. I have an imprint within Bonnier called Heligo Books, which is business, smart thinking, big ideas. The old Ed's link actually wasn't apparent. So Ollie's amazing proposal came to me some months ago, last year, back in 2022. And as a non-maths person, which we'll probably speak a bit more about, as an English lit student, I was really like taken by how amazing a communicator Ollie is about subjects which I know very little about, but I felt I learned so much about why maths is important, how it can make sense of the everyday. It was only later down the line, wasn't it, Ollie, when we kind of talked about some PR angles. I realised that you're also from Birmingham, or near Birmingham, should I say. We're both Aston Villa fans, and we both went to King Edward's. So, and that was 6 months down the line in the germination of the book.
Well, I'm also an Aston Villa fan, and we could very easily get distracted by just how fabulous we all think Unai Emery is. But let's not do that today. Let's talk about the reason that we're here. So, did your passion for maths then start at King Edward School?
Yeah, I think so. Well, I mean, maybe it even started before then, but it was certainly something that was nurtured there and developed by some great teachers there. I think in particular, I mean, I'd pick out Richard Higson, who was there at the time. When I became professor about 5 or 6 years ago, I had we do something called an inaugural lecture where you kind of talk about things, talk about your career, talk about things that you've done. And Richard was able to come to that. And that was great to be able to invite him back and to have him come along. So one of the things he encouraged in me was Maths Olympiads, which, you know, it sounds like a slightly funny thing, but to do these sort of international, well, national and then international competitions. And so I was lucky enough to be selected a couple of times for the UK team. I went once to Sweden in 91 and to Russia in 92. So at that stage, you know, as somebody who was 17 or 18, to have the subject opening the doors, to have that sort of, you know, international travel. I mean, I didn't do brilliantly well in the competitions when I got there, but, you know, it was a real great opportunity to go and visit places off the back of it.
As Rick, I'm more aligned with your sensibilities, the arts over the sciences. And in particular, I think that maths was maybe the only subject that I was in the bottom set for when I was at King Edward Schools. So it really wasn't my thing. What happens at a maths Olympiad then, Oliver? You've flown out to...
It's a slightly strange thing. I'm not sure I could even defend it now as being the best thing for educational practice. But you go and you take two exams. The exams are 4.5 hours each. They have three questions. And, you know, it's possible. I think I had one day where I scored 2 marks in 4.5 hours, which they're hard problems. But, you know, there are teams of six from around the world. You know, different countries compete. So in a sense, it's a chance to meet your sort of contemporaries from around the world. And, you know, the mathematical competition is a small part of it. You know, the social aspect, meeting other people from other cultures and so on is at least as big a part of it. So, you know, it was interesting times.
So in terms of your career next then, it's 1992. You've got your place at Cambridge and you go to Cambridge to study, I imagine, mathematics.
That's right, yes. So, yes. I mean, I think it's one of the things that's quite interesting, sort of looking back again, is that actually I specialised in a big way quite early, you know, compared with what I think maybe people do now and maybe should do now, you know, certainly compared with this baccalaureate that King Edward's is offering now. So I was in the maths sixth, so my A-levels were maths, further maths and physics. So, you know, already at that stage, that was, in some ways, that was quite narrow. So I managed to keep myself a little bit broader. I did GCSE Russian as an option with KEHS, and I did general studies. And actually, I enjoyed general studies. I mean, I think it was something to sort of keep your hand in lots of different things, you know, to do some science, to do some language, still write some things in sentences. That was something I quite enjoyed. And in some ways, that was a bit like what some of the things that I was doing in the pandemic felt a bit like, you know, trying to understand some of the science. There were times when I was reading pandemic documents from France or Germany, you know, from the horse's mouth in the original language and things like that. So it sort of felt like it was going back to that to some extent. But yes, I went to Cambridge, I went to Queen's College, and I did a lot more maths. The degree in Cambridge is quite, well, it doesn't have the option to do courses from to take modules from other courses like some places do. So it was very much a diet of maths, but, you know, it's obviously not all the time, you know, socializing. I helped run the College Music Society for a while, these kinds of things as well. So, you know, I don't want to give the impression I was just doing sums 24/7.
So you've done the PhD. Because I'm just thinking, kind of trying to fill in, you know, the CV, I suppose, bring you up to date before. Because is this your first book, Oliver?
It's my first commercial book. I've written a couple of academic books, but I think it's fair to say, well, I hope the market for this one is bigger than it is for academic books. You know, I think with an academic book, if you sell a few hundred, then you're doing well. So, you know, I have written books before, but they've been very much with lots of equations in. Whereas this one, I think, doesn't have a single equation in it.
So writing academic books, is it very much within the academic world where you've spent your career?
Yeah, so I mean, I moved to Bristol in 2006 as a lecturer, and I, you know, have been promoted within that, but, you know, I work within the maths department. So within the course of that, I mean, not every day splits between these things, but the job splits between research, teaching, and then more sort of general administration type things. So research is finding new maths, you know, trying to develop new results, and that's what ends up in the books. Teaching is, well, speaks for itself, really. And the admin can be lots of things, but often quite a lot of what I do is mentoring. We have quite a lot of PhD students here who I sort of see and act as a mentor for, you know, give them career advice, help them out when things aren't going so well, you know, cheerlead for them to some extent.
I'm really looking forward to talking about the book. The Times have described it as a lucid and entertaining guide to the mathematics that forms the plumbing of the modern world. Because it's a subject that you don't necessarily think of maths and think kind of accessible, do you necessarily? So I'm really interested in talking to you about how you've done that with this book. Before we do, I'd love to talk to you, Rick, a bit more. And I know you want to take a back seat. And I know that as the editorial director...
Well, I think that's the thing of the editor, right? You sort of work in the shadows, you know. You work... you kind of work away on scripts behind the scenes. But I should also add, I mean, Ollie's got some... It's not just Tom Whipple at the Times, but, you know, Tim Harford has given the book an incredible quote, as has, you know, David Spiegelhalter and Anya Bhattacharya, amongst others. So, yeah, we're really excited about launch. And, yeah, Ollie's been very modest about the number of... great endorsements and acclaim already. So yeah, long may it continue.
I mean, just there, the fact that you answered the question with some, you know, and by the way, this person and this person and this, but it shows that you are a fabulous editorial director, Rick. You are great at your job.
Yes.
But I suppose our audience listening to this, we've got lots of old eds listening from boys and girls school across the world, actually. I think they find it a way to kind of, it's nice to connect back with the school and their roots. But also current students listen to this podcast as well, who might be thinking kind of, what are my next steps? What do I want to do? How did you end up as an editorial director? How do I pronounce it? Bonnier Books?
Yeah, so it's Bonnier Books, yeah.
Bonnier.
So Bonnier, yeah. So I guess, obviously, Ollie's talked about his kind of penchant for maths. Mine was always more definitely kind of the language. So, you know, English, felt I had an aptitude and interest in it. Did that for A-level, did Greek and Latin for A-level. I was one of those unhappy people who did maths a year early at our school whilst never quite liking it. So sort of, you know, just good enough to do it, but not good enough to really enjoy it. And looking back, I think, and reading the book as well, I think, I wish I'd known more about maths because it is so critical to our lives. But yeah, I definitely had more of an aptitude for the languages side of things. During uni, I did a very short placement at what was then Random House, what is now Penguin Random House, because they've merged, down at Vauxhall Bridge in London. And yeah, I just absolutely kind of loved it. It, you know, the opportunity to work with books, work with great authors, perhaps have, you know, a say in what gets published, can work on your passions. So that was kind of it, really. And from there, I actually moved back to Birmingham to a very small, sadly no longer exists, but very small, but very brilliant, small publisher called Tindall Street Books, which was, you know, Birmingham based independent. I think it had a crazy record of one in three or one in four of the books were listed for national prize. So whether it's the Booker or, you know, the Desmond Elliott. So yeah, really brilliant publisher, but you know, with the Arts Council funding cuts later on, it didn't quite make it out. But yeah, I was there for a couple of years and I picked up so much. You know, it's a very small office, picked up loads about the business of publishing. From there, I moved down to Simon & Schuster, which was a much bigger publisher, obviously international profile, one of the biggest in the world. And that was, you know, completely different. It's working with, I guess, more mass market, more commercial books, you know, huge profile authors, great sort of people with amazing publishing track records and that kind of stuff. And eventually, yeah, found my way into this position. So, you know, it's kind of a bit of both, really, a bit of the really hands-on work at Tindall Street Press and a bit more of the kind of like working with very big brands and big names at Simon & Schuster. And it's great. I mean, it's great to work with obviously people like Ollie, you know, building a list of really amazing thinkers, of writers, people with something very different to say. And yeah, so that's kind of, you know, that's I guess 12 years of publishing, really, in a nutshell. But yeah, I think you're right in terms of the I guess the school. I thought like the English teaching in the school was absolutely brilliant. You'd remember, you know, Dr. Hosty, Mr. Herbert, my name might ring a bell, who's one of my favorite teachers, and obviously, you know, great sort of English department there. Some great personalities in the classics department as well, who I thought were brilliant. So and I think that gives you a really good grounding, despite, I guess, the natural tug within a school of, you know, being very career focused, if that makes sense.
Oliver, I'd like to move on to talk about the book now. I also want to talk about the process, because I think that's a really interesting, you know, you have an idea for a book, what happens next? But let's talk about the actual content, first of all. Can you explain Number Crunch, a mathematician's toolkit for making sense of your world?
Well, I mean, I think maybe the book and the process go together to some extent. So, I mean, what happened with me was that, well, the same has happened to a lot of people, that suddenly in 2020, we all had a lot more time sitting at home on our hands than we were used to. And so fairly early on in the pandemic, I started realizing that actually, you know, people were not understanding this very well. You know, what was coming out, these numbers were flying around. And I just started sort of tweeting about them a little bit, and it just grew and grew. I mean, I think I started off the pandemic with about 1,000 Twitter followers, and by about, well, by the sort of somewhere into the second wave, I had about 9,000. And it just sort of continued from there, really. So it just seemed to build up and build up. And I mean, it wasn't just the number. I mean, obviously that was nice to feel like I was sort of reaching lots of people, but also actually there was a quality in some sense that I found that there were a lot of journalists, politicians, even actually the sort of quite a lot of the scientists who were doing this, you know, sort of firsthand as a day job, were actually following as well. So that felt quite rewarding, the fact that I was, you know, doing this stuff. I was just sticking out basically graphs and numbers and commentary, and that people found it useful. So, well, in the first lockdown, you know, I did that. And then in the beginning of the second lockdown, I sort of looked back and thought, well, okay, what did I have to show for that? You know, I did a lot of tweets and those were gone. But so I thought at the beginning of the second lockdown, well, you know, I've got a month here. We're all going to be sitting at home. Why not try and do something a bit more concrete? So at that stage, I sort of sat down every morning and tried to do some writing. And I think by the end of the second lockdown, so about a month later, I had about 40,000 words, which I now realize isn't enough. I mean, it felt like a lot at the time, but I now realize that isn't enough. But it was enough that I could then sort of go out to agents. I mean, this is the other big part of the process, was going out to agents, talking to agents, getting, you know, polite rejections, but getting rejections from a lot of them, but being lucky to be picked up by somebody who is an absolute star in the world of being an agent, you know. And I, the more I see of Will, the more I feel lucky to have him. But yes, so at that stage, then Will picked it up and was, you know, prepared in principle to act, gave me some feedback in terms of what the book was. Originally, the book was very much COVID focused, which I think was to do with the fact that I'd written it in those sort of dark mornings of lockdown two, and that, you know, it was very much focused on COVID. And he sort of convinced me really that it needed to be more than that, and that it should be more than that, and that it shouldn't just be that maths was a tool to make sense of COVID, but that maths was a tool to make sense of lots of things. So at that stage, when I'd done that, that's probably about when Rick joined, that Will went out to a lot of publishers. Rick saw it, and, you know, the rest is history in some sense.
It was such a bizarre time. You know, that's something that we all talk about a lot. We look back on it and think, God, blimey, did that actually really happen? But also, it was a very emotional time. I suppose when you were tweeting in that first and second lockdown, were you tweeting the facts? Can you just tweet the facts, or does everything that you put out into the kind of social media sphere come with a bit of opinion, maybe?
It's a fair comment. I mean, I don't think any number is ever completely neutral. And that's sort of something that I try to talk about in the book, is that all these things come with a certain amount of context, and that, you know, you can present the same statistic in different ways and have a different impact with it. But I think my aim with all of this has always been to be as, I mean, maybe everybody would say this, but to be as straightforward as I can about it. I don't feel like I have a particular agenda. I think my brand was that when things were going up, you know, when numbers were rising, I wasn't happy about it. When numbers were coming down, I was happy about it. So that's what I tried to be, was to be, I mean, it's impossible, but the aim was to be an interpreter, to not be sort of putting too much of a narrative on it, because I feel like the numbers can only go so far. They can inform a decision, but you can't set policy purely based on the numbers. That there is a sort of human context as well.
I think that I speak for a lot of people when I say that I over that period, I've never been more interested in numbers than I was during the pandemic. You know, the daily press briefings, what does this mean? What does that mean? So you were kind of tweeting and explaining for the general public, you know, for people like me that were in set five of maths, GCSE, couldn't wait to drop it. You were kind of explaining it from your perspective, the numbers. The book then, some very rudimentary numbers, 40,000 words in 4 weeks. 10,000 words a week is quite impressive, isn't it, Rick?
I'd like to say that's the gold standard. That's super impressive. I think, I don't know, everyone's got their own methods of working, but I think to write that much and good stuff in a short amount of time, yeah. Super impressive.
I'm not saying they were good words. I'm saying they were good words.
But you can't edit nothing. Do you know what I mean? You've got to get something on the page to be able to look back through and go, well, that one's that bit's rubbish, that bit's rubbish. So what else? In terms of this book then, it started the germ of the idea came from COVID in that time. But what else are you explaining through maths in Number Crunch?
Well, I mean, lots of things, really. I mean, so for example, exponential growth, it's, you know, something that we heard about a lot during the pandemic, you know, these numbers, doubling rates and all these kinds of things. But actually, that is a process that I think people maybe understand better than they used to, but certainly at the time didn't understand brilliantly, and they really needed to. But actually, you know, once you understand exponential growth, lots of other processes behave in that way. So there are examples in the book to do with things like computing power, obviously it's slower, but there's something called Moore's law, which says that computing power doubles roughly every 18 months. And so that's how, you know, the next generation of iPhone is so much more brilliant. And then if you go back 15 years, that's 10 generations of 18 months. That's a thousandfold improvement. Yeah, this is how exponential growth works. It builds up. It's like money in a bank account builds up. I mean, there's a sort of silly example as well in that chapter, football transfer fees, that, again, those for a long period of time grew fairly consistently, exponentially. So this is the hook, really, is that I think, you know, people from the pandemic, they wanted to learn about this stuff. And, you know, exponential growth is something they'd heard about. So to try and explain what that is, how it works, but also where else they see it, where else it crops up, and to understand, you know, the dangers and the benefits of it, really.
I thought the thing which resonated a lot with me and some other people who read it was how maths can make sense of social media, whether it's kind of the filter bubble or, you know, paying attention to like outliers or kind of strange voices. And the thing which captured me, Ollie, was the idea of entropy, which means a very different thing to, you know, an English lit student. That's a very clear, like, mathematical idea. It was based around one of your heroes, was it Claude Shannon? Mm-hmm. And the way you made sense of how packets and parcels of information work across social media, I thought was, yeah, so captivating because, you know, especially during lockdown, we're either looking at government stats or whatever else it is, or trying to distract ourselves with social media. So I think it kind of perfectly captured the moment.
The entropy is interesting because that comes from an area called information theory, and that's actually what I do research in. That's my day job in some sense. And what that captures is it captures some idea of unpredictability. That's what lies at the heart of it. So, for example, I mean, you know, we talked about football. The Villa are fairly unpredictable. You never quite know what you're going to get. You know, you switch on the results. Who knows what the result will be? Whereas a team like Man City, they're fairly predictable. Most of the time, they're going to win. And so you would say that there is more entropy in Villa's results than there is in Manchester City's results. So you learn more when you switch on the football scores and see the Villa score than you do when you see the Man City score. And so this is an idea that is very useful because it captures the sort of content of information. When you talk about, for example, if you take a photo on your phone, you don't save every single pixel that you capture on your phone onto your memory card. You kind of squash it down into a JPEG. And the amount of information that you need to do that is sort of captured by the entropy, that the entropy is a sort of measure of stuff in, you know, a measure of value. So how that fits in with the social media is that, well, it's not just social media, it's media in general, I think, that there's a question of what you're getting from it when you read stuff. If there is a columnist who always says exactly the same, you know what they're going to say before you even open the article, then they're the kind of Manchester City of the punditry world, that you know, it's very, very predictable. You're not gaining very much from them. So what you should be looking for is I guess maybe this comes back to Rick's point about sort of iconoclastic voices, that to voices that are more independent, that, you know, don't follow a particular party line. And then if you can get multiple of those voices, you know, read lots of people that are interesting and then make a decision based on that, rather than just reading the person whose politics you agree with already to confirm that you're correct. Because I think that's dangerous. I think if you only ever read people on your side, then that's how you end up, you know, in a filter bubble. I think that's how people have gone down this sort of anti-vax rabbit hole, for example, is if you only read anti-vaxxers, then you convince yourself that point of view is the only sensible one and is more, you know, more widespread than it is. So, you know, I think it's a serious issue, this polarization.
Something I was going to ask you about that, Ollie, which is completely, I was thinking about it and I could be completely wrong about this. Does that also mean that people can pay more attention to voices which are completely so out of the mainstream that because the information is new and surprising, they feel they've learned more from it rather than listening, watching verified sources, if that makes sense, where the information isn't necessarily surprising, but it's so overlapping, you're not getting a huge chunk of new information.
I think that is a good point. So I think clearly you don't want to just accept something at face value because it is surprising, because it is independent. So somehow you want to have a sense of correctness as well.
Yeah.
But I guess what I'm saying is that the correctness may not be necessarily in, you know, the approved sources. That sometimes you can have an element of groupthink whereby, well, I mean, the classic one I think would be masks. You know, early in the pandemic, it was well known that masks wouldn't have any effect. The World Health Organization advised against wearing masks. Adverts were being banned for masks, and, you know, some people actually questioned that. And so, you know, it would have been very easy to stay in that, you know, masks are no good, we need to be washing our hands kind of role. So I think there is this value in having voices coming in from outside and just, you know, questioning things and just, you know, kicking the tires on things, really.
It's really interesting hearing you speak about this, Oliver, because what you're saying earlier about your tweets, you know, you're presenting the information. It sounds like in this book, you're presenting the information, but there's also a bit of a manifesto there. there's a purpose behind this book, as well as just kind of presenting you with the toolkit.
I would say that maybe the purpose is the toolkit. The hope is that people will read this and be in a more informed position to think for themselves. Early on in the book, I talk about just, you know, purely numbers themselves, you know, numbers that you hear in the news. And just, you know, stupid examples, you know, the fact that a million and a billion sound very similar. Yet, you know, you hear in the budget that there's a proposal that costs £1 million, and you hear there's a proposal that costs £1 billion. And that's a vastly different amount of money. You know, a million pounds is 1.5p per head in this country. £1 billion is £15 a head. So, you know, it's a big difference. And I think people aren't as used as they should be to sort of thinking in these sort of terms, just to break things down, put things in context. So, like I say, the aim isn't to tell people what to think. I think it's more to tell people how to think.
And Rick, as a English literature student, fan of the arts and fringes and grunge music, how has this book then helped you to make sense of your world?
Great question. And just on that point as well, I was interested, Ollie, that you dedicated the book to all the great maths teachers in your life, which I thought was a very nice touch. But yes, how does it make sense? Well, I think in all sorts of ways, really. I think because we are bombarded with so much information everywhere we go, we, you know, switch on our phones, go on social media, you know, switch on the news, whatever it is. And often the information I've found is very contradictory, and it depends on who's repeating this information, what source you're getting it from, even if it's about a similar thing. So I think for me, the idea of having that critical view of being able to see through data, whether it is on a graph shown on the news. Okay, so why is this not? Why have they chosen to portray the graph, you know, using this sort of axis rather than a log, you know, or use a log scale? Whether it's thinking about how social media operates. I thought there were some incredible things here around, you know, how Siri works or how Alexa works. Great stuff about betting odds, which I wish I'd known before. But there's every aspect of our world which is important to us. This book does touch on, you know, even like how weather forecasts are sort of, you know, predicted, if you like, and what the probability is of getting it wrong. So for me, it touched on every sort of element of our kind of our daily life, really. I thought that was the most interesting to me. And just the way it's communicated, I think Ollie's a really good, brilliant communicator of complex things, especially for, you know, someone like me who's got, you know, GCSE maths, and that was it. That was enough. It sort of opens a door again to an understanding of maths, which a lot of people may have felt they'd left behind, you know, in school or at the end of uni or whatever it is. So I think that's what really struck me. And I hope that's what people get from the book.
After my PhD, I was in Cambridge still as a postdoc for a couple of positions I had. And I was actually based in Christ College, which is interesting because that was where C.P. Snow used to be a fellow. And C.P. Snow, of course, wrote this great essay about the two cultures, about, you know, science and the arts, and never the twain shall meet. And I absolutely don't think that should be the case. You know, I don't think they are two separate things. You know, I think it's incumbent on mathematicians and other scientists to be able to communicate and to explain what it is that they do. So whether that's on social media or by writing a book or whatever, I don't think it's any excuse that, you know, scientists, we're scientists, we don't need to be able to write properly, because we do.
What next for you, first of all, Oliver? That the book comes out tomorrow as we record this. What happens after the book's out?
Well, I don't know. I'm excited to see, really. I mean, it like I say, it's been a long journey, really, getting this far. So yes, just finally, I mean, it was exciting to send it out to some of these readers. Rick mentioned people like Tim Harford and David Spiegelhalter. So, you know, obviously it's slightly nervous sending your baby out into the world to meet those, you know, those great communicators. So they've seen it, but now it's just sort of going out to the general public. I'm interested to know how it lands, really.
Well, I've seen the quotes from those guys and they are very complimentary.
Yes, I'm very pleased.
Rick, how about you?
In terms of the list here at Heligo Books, so we have books commissioned all the way up to 2026 already. So we're kind of looking for books, you know, 3, 4, 5 years in advance. And that stretches across a huge range of topics, whether it's smart thinking, so books that essentially make us think differently about the way we think and about the way we view the world, to kind of core business management leadership books, to self-development and self-help, to reportage and journalism and expose. So the next kind of big book, I guess, we have coming out is called Anatomy of a Breakthrough by the New York Times bestselling author Adam Alter, which we're very excited about. And that's essentially a roadmap to getting unstuck. So all of us feel stuck at some point in our lives, whether it's personally, professionally, creatively, even in sports. And this basically offers a roadmap for breaking through and getting unstuck and taking our lives, careers to the next level. Later on in the year, we have a book by Josh Littlejohn, MBE, which is all about social entrepreneurship. So it's called Paying It Forward. And it's essentially a guide to putting purpose over profit. Next year, we have a brilliant expose of Silicon Valley kind of tech bro culture. And we have a book about negotiating called Be Who You Are to Get What You Want. And then looking even ahead further, we have a brilliant, really fascinating book all about plastic pollution, which traces the way that companies have essentially hoodwinked us for decades, which we're very much seeing in the kind of bad blood empire of pain sort of vibes. And to kind of round that little summary off, we have a book which is The First Natural History of Our Oceans for Decades, which is a real comprehensive look at all the incredible creatures and environments that make up, you know, 80, 85, 90% of our world. So that's just picking out a few from, you know, 25 books we have commissioned so far. Another great thing I think about the list is that we are really inclusive. So it's very important to me to create a list in which readers can see themselves. So last year, for example, half of our lists were by writers of colour. We had complete gender parity across our list as well, which is a crazy thing to have to say in 2023, but it's still a very important thing to bring up, because I think we're probably the most inclusive business smart thinking list in the UK, probably in the English speaking world. So I think it's something definitely to shout about. So yeah, that's a bit of a potted summary.
Gents, I don't know who wants to answer this one first, but I've got to ask you, what characteristic would you say has served you best through your career? I'm thinking about those younger listeners who are still in that green jumper or blue blazer. And what would you say has served you best? And Rick, I'm going to come to you first, because you're smiling. It looks like you've got a great answer ready to go.
No, I was just thinking of that image of, like, you know, kids in their blue blazer or green jumper. And I was like, ah, oh, I remember those days. So I was a kind of fond, wistful smile. Yeah, I mean, I think there was a real sense of, like, what I guess I'd call now collaboration, of teamwork, of kind of working together. You know, whether it was, you know, playing rugby. I didn't just quote Catullus. I played a bit of rugby as well, kind of first team and stuff. And there was a real team atmosphere in the school. There's a real sense of we're in whatever we're doing together. Everyone was very happy to help each other out. A sense of collaboration, a sense of shared. I mean, I'm using very kind of jargony terms, but there was a real sense of purpose about being at King Edward's. And that was manifested in everything from, like I said, from sports to, you know, future careers to, I don't know, charitable work. So, yeah, I think I'd just say really, really delve into everything the school has to offer in terms of working with your fellow, you know, your peers, fellow pupils, teachers, and just wring every bit out of it, because it's a really great place to go to school, and it's a great place to learn from other people.
I love that, the there was a sense of purpose. You were always doing something, weren't you, when you were at King Edward's? Oliver, how about you?
Yeah, I think it's maybe a similar answer. I mean, I think the sense that there was a sort of niche for everybody, that, you know, Rick was playing rugby, I wasn't playing rugby, I hated rugby, but, you know, I found other things to do. I used to go cross-country running. I hated rugby so much, I would rather go on a 6-mile cross-country run than play rugby, but, you know, it didn't matter. So I think that feeling that whatever you are, whoever you are, there is a niche for you, and it's just about finding that niche and finding the thing that makes you happy. But that, you know, when you do find a niche, that it shouldn't become a silo for you. Like I say, just because you're doing maths, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't read books by people that don't have spaceships on the cover, and you know, you shouldn't accept it as an excuse for not being able to write in sentences yourself, and this kind of thing. So I think that those are the values I would take away.
Professor Oliver Johnson and Rick Ubi, thank you so much for your time today on Ed Talks. It's been lovely to meet you.
Oh, thank you, Ben. That was great.
Thank you for listening to Ed Talks. I hope that you've enjoyed today's conversation. If you have, it would be great if you could subscribe to this podcast on whatever app you're listening on, so you can keep up to date with future episodes. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, then we'd really appreciate it if you could leave your feedback in the review section. If you're listening on a platform where you can't leave your comments, then please do email me with your feedback. My email address is ben@soundrebel.co.uk.